Mr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that determines what the future will bring. And ladies and gentlemen, you must understand that the media in the United States is controlled largely by five mega corporations, certainly according to Dr. Ben Bagdicki and in his book, The New Media Monopoly. 90 to 95% of the major outlets, and I'm talking about the publishers, the magazines, the newspapers, and major television and major radio, are controlled by five mega corporations that all basically are heading in the same direction. They all want world government. They play little games, some pretending they're conservative, some pretending they're liberal, none of them really telling you the truth. And as you'll notice, when was the last time you heard about the other Republican candidate who is still running for the presidency? His name is Ron Paul. You'll hear about Ralph Nader. They'll interview Ralph Nader. And they'll talk about, of course, the three candidates, McCain, Obama, and Hillary. They will never mention Ron Paul, Congressman Ron Paul. Why? Because he's not part of the establishment. All the others are. And it's really not going to make a dime's worth of difference whether you get the Democrat or the Republican in. Why, the policies will be essentially the same. Now, right now, as we look at what's going on, this evening we're going to have with us Bob Chapin from who is from the International Forecaster. We're going to be talking about what's happening financially. You're not getting the truth about what's going on financially. For instance, last Friday, when Citicorp announced that they had lost $5.2 billion in the first quarter and Merrill Lynch had lost $2.1 billion in the first quarter, the market goes up 228 points. It should have collapsed, but you see, the market is manipulated. It is perfectly all right to manipulate it as long as you're the government, because they're playing games with our mind. They want to create the perception that things are really not so bad. Maybe we're over the worst part of this financial problem, and maybe things are going to get better now. Maybe you better get back in the market quick before other people do while it's still going up. And you must understand that we are facing the worst financial collapse since the Great Depression, and perhaps even greater than that, because at least we had a solid currency at that time, a gold-backed currency, and we did not have simply trillions and trillions of dollars, probably in the neighborhood of between $50 and $60 trillion of real debt. And if we were required to have the real debt put forward, that's what it would be, with the money we promised to pay out in Social Security and Medicare, and there is no Medicare fund, there is no Social Security fund. All there are IOUs from a government that has to borrow $2.5 billion a day just to pay its bills, and maybe even more than that. Our smaller banks across America are preparing to go under. Many of them are having real financial problems. Our major banks are having to borrow money from other countries just to keep afloat, and of course, the Federal Reserve System is pouring money out, destroying the value of our currency and the savings of our people, whereas the European Bank is saying, well, we've got to be concerned about inflation. We may even have to have a rate hike. Well, this is Bob Chapin. Bob, what do you think is going to happen? Is the Federal Reserve going to continue lowering interest rates and pouring the money out to save Wall Street? Or do you think they're going to do what's right and try to save the dollar and the savings of our and the lifetime investments of our people?
Well, there's absolutely no chance that they're going to save the dollar. And the bent that they've taken is to save Wall Street and the banks, particularly the big banks. The big banks and Wall Street, for all intents and purposes, are bankrupt. They are getting infusions from other sources, private equity groups, hedge funds, rich foreigners, and foreign sovereign funds have contributed as well. And we're talking well over $100 billion thus far.
$100 billion, right.
And it's not only American banks, it's foreign banks as well. What did you say, Stan?
Oh, I said billion. I thought you said, I want to make sure people understood it was billion, not $1 million.
Yeah, billion.
Right.
And so we're faced with a survival operation, and that's being orchestrated by the Fed and the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, Swiss National Bank, and the Canadian Bank of Canada. And they are lending money to financial entities, which in turn will lend money to others, such as businesses and speculators and so on, but mostly to business. And banking has curtailed a lot of their lending incumbent upon these loans from the Fed because they really don't have any money, because they have so much bad debt in their books that if they had to declare it, they'd be declared bankrupt. And so what they're trying to do over the next 2 or 3 years is accumulate enough earnings to offset these tremendous losses, most of which have been not declared yet. The credit crisis, which started last August, 9 months ago, is worse now than it was then. Bankers don't trust each other, and there's no confidence in the system.
Well, I see that, and of course, over in Australia, the Australian Central Bank is buying up all this bad debt based upon the CDOs and the asset-backed securities and the structured investment vehicles. They're just, Australia is buying it up, and in many respects, isn't the Federal Reserve, which is our privately owned central bank, isn't our central bank buying up some of our what you call toxic paper, or the all these bonds which really are not performing? Why would they be buying up, you know, bonds that are simply no good to the core, maybe worth 30 cents on the dollar and giving credit for 100 cents on the dollar? It doesn't make sense.
Well, again, it is the salvation of the financial world that they're after. They don't care about the public or anything else. And all of this debt that's being created and monetized in some instances quickly, and that is quickly inflationary, that's very, very important to Americans because they're paying with higher inflation, and the American people on the loans that the Federal Reserve is giving and the loans that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Sally Mae.
Hold those thoughts. We'll be right back here in just a moment with Bob Chapin. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Bob is simply talking about the massive debts that are out there and how certainly the Federal Reserve System, the central banks, are actually buying up paper that they know, they're buying bonds that they know is not worth what it's costing, but they're doing everything they can, of course, to try to stabilize the economic system, pouring more money out. But the problem is not liquidity. There's plenty of liquidity, and so many of our financial institutions are insolvent because they bought a lot of assets, whether it would be automobile loans, or whether it would be student loans, or whether they be housing loans, and people simply are not paying their bills. And when people don't pay their bills, why, of course, the bonds that are based upon those bills begin to become worthless or lose a great deal of their value. And so basically everything is being done to get the banks out of the position they're in, the financial institutions, but in the process they're destroying the value of our currency. Everybody's concerned because the price of oil is going up. And nobody ever points out the reason the price of oil and foodstuffs and so many things are going up is because the value of the dollar is going down. Certainly there is inflation throughout the rest of the world, but it really all begins right here with the Federal Reserve System churning out Federal Reserve notes and then destroying the economy, not only the United States, but the entire world. Inflation has nothing to do with rising prices. It's a direct result of increasing the money supply. Increase the money supply, you decrease the value of money, you create inflation, and that's where we're going, right? Go ahead, Bob.
Well, I agree with you, and the situation is far, far worse than what people realize, even people who work on Wall Street, because they're not really privy, nor do they have time to delve into the research that's needed to find out just how bad the situation is. And on top of that, we have people within government and the financial industry, as well as corporate America, who stand up and just lie about things in behalf of the people who have caused this problem in the first place. And you and I have discussed this many times in the program, and this just didn't happen by accident or happenstance. It was planned this way.
Right.
And so you're seeing great consolidation going on, and it will continue. About 150 to 300 banks are going to go under in the next couple of years. Most of them small and medium-sized because they're holding, which you mentioned before, toxic waste, which is bonds, which are consist of mortgages. And then coming along, we have another problem, and that problem is a whole new set of loans that haven't gone bad yet that are about to, and those are loans made for swimming pools, mobile homes, motorcycles, vehicles, particularly revolving credit, and the worst of all, the credit cards. And I see already that allowance is being set aside by Bank of America and Citicorp for massive, I mean billions of dollars in losses in that area. And so they think over the next couple of years that's going to be a big surprise to everybody, and that'll be where the next scandal is. But still, it's going to come along at the same time that the real estate and mortgage debacle is taking place.
And because really, real estate debacle is just getting started. People want you to think, oh, we may be just turning the corner. More and more homes are being foreclosed on, and as the price of homes falls, why people, you know, who may even have had a fairly good credit rating are finding that they're paying on a mortgage that is worth far more than the house that they have. And of course, as long as eventually, sooner or later, people get the idea, why should I be paying a mortgage on a house that isn't worth anywhere near what I'm paying on the mortgage? And they're just walking away from their homes and leaving everything behind. Just simply mailing the keys to the house back to the people who hold the loan, or at least who think they hold the loan, the bank they got it from. But now, of course, their loan has been rolled over into a bond someplace, and nobody even knows who holds that bond. But you go right ahead, Bob.
Well, you know, when that happens, judges are saying that until you tell me who owns it, then you can't foreclose on this property. And it's happening all over the country. And it's quite concerning because the bankers have created a monstrosity for themselves because they can't prove ownership. And so that's another aspect that most people don't discuss. And, of course, there are a lot of foreclosures that are not foreclosures, these short sales, and what's happening, the lenders are doing that so that people will stay in the homes, so the homes aren't looted of their bathrooms and piping and their roofs, and goodness knows what else they steal from homes. And so the homes in foreclosure and the homes available for sale are really understated. Maybe by a large amount at that. But you're right, Stan. We can't see a bottom on real estate, generally speaking, at least for 2 to 3 years. And then it'll take at least 10 years of bottoming before it goes up again. And a person who bought a house for $600,000 could easily see it, if you live in California as an example, could see it at $325,000. And it could stay there for 20 years.
I
just don't know.
I wanted to explain that this term short sale to our listeners. Basically, if you have a house, you have a mortgage on a house that is higher than the value of the house, and you want to sell it. Of course, if you sell the house, why, let's say you'd bought the house for $600,000, it's now worth $400,000, and you want to sell the house, you're going to be, of course, behind $200,000. Well, I mean, certainly you don't want to have to pay that $200,000 to the person who lent you the money. And many times the people who lent you the money will actually go ahead and absorb the loss, say maybe a 10, 20% of the value. And then, of course, because that's better than foreclosing and losing 40% of the value of the home. And so basically the short sales are what people sell for less than the mortgage. The lender absorbs the difference, because if they don't do that and they let the house stand vacant, why what's going to happen is they're going to lose even more. So rather than lose 40%, they'll be happy to lose only 20%. That's called a short sale, and many of the lenders will go along with that. But, of course, then they have to find some means of making up that money. That's why so many of our banks are having to borrow money from other countries or from other investors just to stay solvent, because they're losing so much money on the homes that they've lent money on. Pick up the story there, Bob.
Well, that's true. And one of the things that most people know about are subprime loans and auto loans. And they'll probably stretch out over the next year and a half to 2 years. But we also have option loans, which are taken out by people who had much better credit, but they mortgage themselves to the hilt. In other words, instead of paying $3,000 a month mortgage rates, they opted to play the market and pay $600 a month. And they played interest only, normally. And so each month the money owed on the house goes up. And so by, 2 years go by and they find out that what they originally owed in the house, $600,000, is now $700 or whatever. And of course the house is now worth $450,000, so they're offside $250,000, which the lender is going to end up eating. And so there's another wave coming after the subprime ALTA group. And so this will stretch over 4 or 5 years. And then you have the bottoming process. But that is also accompanied by the credit debacle, where banks won't lend to each other because they don't have any confidence or trust in the system anymore. And also, that spreads into all facets of industry. And that's why the Fed is pumping out about $275, $300 billion a month now in short-term loans, 28-day loans, we'll say monthly loans, which are renewable. And they also are increasing the money supply, that's money and credit, and at the same time, they're in the repo market, and they're also creating money there to go into the system.
And all of that is...
So
that,
I think we can safely say it's $300 billion a month.
Because that's all highly inflationary, just destroying the value of people's pensions and savings and insurance policies and CDs and treasury bonds. Certainly the bonds are going down in value as the value of the dollar declines. And that's what it's really all about. And the average person really doesn't understand. Oh, of course, what Alan Greenspan said in his book, The Age of Turbulence, where he talked about Lenin, who said, "There is no better way to destroy a nation than to debauch its currency." And not one person in a million will understand. Well, I hope the listeners to our programs understand that they're intentionally and purposely and maliciously debauching our currency. Certainly the European Central Bank is much more concerned. In fact, they're even talking about raising interest rates to try to preserve their currency. And the Federal Reserve System is intent upon destroying our currency. And in the process, of course, they will enslave our people. Well, Bob, you pick up the story there.
What we had over this weekend was that the Bank of England said that they were going to increase the amount of money they were going to loan out by $200 billion. And that money will be for 1 year. And it's renewable for a three-year period in total. And goodness knows what they're going to do after that. What this is all leading to is monetization. And what's going to happen is the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve and other central banks, they will take in the collateral, which about 65% of the loan collateral is in this toxic paper. When all is said and done, it'll be worth 10 or 20 cents on the dollar. And those losses are going to be absorbed by American and British citizens in this instance. And taxes will be raised to offset that. And the bankers and the lenders and the raters and the mortgage people and the credit issuers are all going to be bailed out by the British and the American public in this case. And that's where that's headed. And that means that this is all going to be monetized. And that monetization process means that the debt no longer belongs to the banks, but belongs to the central bank. It belongs to the people. And that means that you and I have to pay to bail out the financial industry in the United States that caused all this in the first place. It's an absolute dreadful position for citizens of the United States to be in, and it's unfair, it's fraud, it's criminal, and that's what our government is. It's a criminal enterprise run by the Federal Reserve and bankers and investment bankers.
But then this is really sort of a small clique that are really doing this. The average American, the average government employee has no idea what's going on. The average person doesn't even understand the foundation of money. The fact that we have a fiat money system with absolutely no value. They create money out of nothing and then they lend it to people and charge interest on it. It is one of the greatest scams in the world. But of course, the whole idea of fiat money is a scam. In fact, it was Daniel Webster said there's certainly no basic way of cheating the working man. There's nothing more than the delusion of paper money. The delusion of paper money, people really think it has value, but it doesn't. Daniel Webster understood that, back in about 1840, warning the people. Thomas Jefferson understood it. He talked about how we were going to be destroyed at that time by the paper money that they were issuing so freely through the First Bank of the United States. And, of course, when Congress had the good sense to cancel the charter of the First Bank of the United States, then, of course, we were at war with Great Britain. Why? To punish the United States for doing away with our central bank, which was controlled by the Europeans. And today, of course, our central bank is controlled by private banking interests that link to the European banking institutions, and the banks really control largely our society. If you doubt that, you should read the book written by Bill Clinton's mentor, a book called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, which we do carry, which was suppressed for many years, and on page 324, why Professor Quigley talks about how they plot about bringing about a world feudalistic society. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest is Bob Chapman, and if you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, and I think that probably Bob would tell you that probably the worst thing that you could do right now would be investing in this stock market, because, of course, it may even go up quite a bit further. But, of course, this whole thing is manipulated, and one of these days it's going to fall out of bed, and when it does, and begins to return to some sort of relationship between the value of the stocks and what it's costing, why, of course, an awful lot of people are going to lose even more of their life savings. So you go right ahead, Bob.
Well, I agree with that. I think that it's just too dangerous to be in that market, because we know what they're doing. And they have admitted that what they're doing, and of course it's legal for them to do that because of Ronald Reagan's executive order. And so they're going to continue to do what they've been doing, and they're not going to stop. And it'll all end up in hyperinflation. And as I said earlier, both the inflation will rob people of their purchasing power, and at the same time, taxes will be raised to produce the money from the labors of the people to pay off the debt of the bankers and Wall Street and corporate America. And that's the way it's going to go. And the only way we can change that, as you mentioned, is by electing Ron Paul as president. And as you say, the control media doesn't even mention his name because they don't want people to know that he exists. And yes, the managed news is managed, and all of the media is controlled by the same group of people, which is the Illuminati. And it's just another adjunct to what they're doing and have been doing for a long time.
Well, of course, the Illuminati is the modern-day manifestation of the ancient mystery religions, and call it the Illuminati, call it what you will. There is a small group of people who rule the world. They do down through the generations, of course. And, of course, what most people don't understand is the powerful spiritual forces behind these people who accumulate great wealth because, of course, they've given their allegiance to the other god. Well, right now we've got Mark calling from Florence in Oregon. Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good, Dr. Stan, and you sound great.
Well, thank you so much.
And Bob sounds, as usual, great and on top of the ball. And I really have a question for Bob. I've been curious lately. I've been seeing how much the effect of the central banks, essentially, and there may be some other concerns that dump gold on the market and keep the price down, essentially, from where it would naturally go to. And I've been curious as to what Bob would think about the current situation and how much of this activity of dumping the gold on the market in metric amounts, what would those amounts be total or comparative to what they have available totally to be able to do this, which would be relative to how long can they do it. And I'll take my answer off the air, and thanks for the great program.
Thanks very much, Mark. And that was Mark calling from Florence, Oregon. Of course, the question is, how long are the central banks going to be able to continue, dumping gold on the market to drive the price down? And I think another question might very well be asked is, well, they're selling it, 50 tons of gold here and 50 tons of gold there. Who's got the money to buy 50 tons of gold? I mean, I certainly don't, and I don't think you do either. So obviously, when they're selling this gold, it's going into the hands of people with a great deal of wealth. Go ahead.
Well, I think you're right about that. And I think that a good part, all the way up in price of gold, has been purchased by the people who are causing this problem in the first place, because they know this, where this is all going. And so it's just like an IMF sale. If it isn't used for short covering, or if it isn't used to even up the books, or if it isn't used for countries' sovereign funds, it'll be used by the insiders who started this thing in the first place, because they know gold is the only money, believe me.
And I believe that, of course, the Rockefellers and others were over there buying up, countless billions of dollars worth of gold. In fact, there was a Dennis Cuddy tells me some years ago, America sold some of its gold in the European markets, and who should buy it but the Rockefellers? How do we know? Well, because one of their employees, a woman, made that public statement, and shortly before she died under very mysterious circumstances. You're not supposed to know, ladies and gentlemen, that there are a few families out there that are purchasing this gold. Why? Because I think eventually we're going to have a gold-backed currency. Privately issued gold-backed currency. And we'll be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest is Bob Chapin, and we're talking about what's really going on in the world today financially, the things you're not going to hear elsewhere, the realization that a fiat money system always collapses. They have down through the ages. And let's go to Randy, who's calling us from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Randy. How are you doing?
Oh, good, sir. I just want to thank you for all the work you do, Stan. You're a real patriot, my man.
Well, thank my wife, too. She puts up with me and keeps me going. So anyway, what can we do for you?
Well, I wanted to ask Bob Chapman about a financial question. If I should sell a rental and buy gold or just stay tight?
No,
is that all right to ask something like that?
No. Well, basically, what were the alternatives?
Well, I have a house free and clear
right. That
I live in, four-bedroom house. My daughters are all moved out. My wife has MS, and I don't know, her life expectancy is probably less than 10 years. I'm 56, but I have a $50,000 one-bedroom rental, and I wonder if I should sell the rental, buy gold, or just stay tat with the house.
All right, that's a good question. What do you think, Bob?
Well, I think if you can get the price that you want for it or something close to it in today's selling environment, then I would take it and sell it and diversify that money in gold and silver-related assets.
So a house will be more valuable than... I mean, gold and silver will be more valuable than a house.
Well, no, I don't see a house tripling, and that could easily happen to gold and much more in silver, perhaps.
Yeah.
It depends. We really don't know, but we can surmise that possibility is a very good one. And
right.
So there's just no comparisons at this stage. Of those
long term, the gold and silver will be more valuable than the rental.
Absolutely.
Because you need to keep your own home for your wife, so she has the security of having a home. But the rental, certainly it's nice to have the income from it, but I think the upside potential on gold and silver is really tremendous. Now, remember, I'm not a financial advisor.
Right.
I'm just sort of an amateur historian, but I've been watching this for almost as long as Bob has, and I agree
right.
with him. I think that this is, especially right now, of course, when the price of gold and silver have been beaten down.
That house is only worth about $50,000 in Spokane, though.
Right, I know, but...
But say you buy a lot of gold and silver over that. I had 90 ounces, but I kind of... Well, I needed money at times, but I'm still into it. And, Bob, I thank you, and you and Pat, for your Truth Seekers. I just love that show. And, Dr. Stan, you guys are just... We owe you guys a lot, and I thank you, both of you, and God bless you both.
Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you very much.
God bless. Bye-bye.
You say hello to Pat for me, Bob.
I will.
Take care, guys. Thanks
okay,
again.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
What's Pat's last name? We'll be back here in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Bob Chapin. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you have a question for Bob, but right now I want Bob to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with him, get a copy of the world by me of the International Forecaster, and perhaps even want to subscribe. I will tell you quite honestly that I look forward to coming twice a week. It's 25 pages or so, but a lot of fascinating information that will keep you abreast of what's really going on in the world. So, Bob, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, they can go to our website, and they can get a copy there, or they can call. The forecast is about business, finance, economics, and social and political issues all over the world, and we publish by email twice a week on Wednesdays and Saturdays. Runs around 25 or 30 pages each time. And we have a hard copy as well that goes out twice a month. So you can go to the site, and that address is theinternationalforecaster.com. The International, FORECASTER.com. If you'd like to email us, that address is international_forecaster@yahoo.com. international_forecaster@yahoo.com, and the telephone number toll free is 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188.
All right, fine. Let's go to Charles. He's calling from Harlem. Hi, Charles. How are you doing?
How are you, Dr. Chapman?
I'm doing just fine. Do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I do. Mr. Robert Chapman, I'm a subscriber. I appreciate everything you do. I got one question. Couldn't the, and this is regarding gold, couldn't the powers that be continue to sell gold into the market and almost like playing catch to depress or suppress the price of gold and have physical outtake from their buddies who may have sovereign wealth funds or whoever, and then those guys continue to just kind of the same gold back and forth, buying and selling, and I'll take your comments off the air about using that to suppress the market. So it doesn't mean they need more gold, but they just keep selling the gold to each other back and forth.
Okay, fine. Now, what are your thoughts on that, Bob?
Well, I think as we go along here, it becomes more and more evident because there is very little effort to hide the manipulation of precious metals prices as well as the intercession of the Treasury and the Fed in the stock market as well as the commodity market. And so I think the question really is with gold, how much do the central banks have left? And we really don't know. I don't think anybody knows, but I think it's safe to assume that the 33,000 tons that they say that they have collectively is not there. And if anything, they might have 5,000 tons left. That's possible. But I think it's down that far. And the selling that you're seeing today is not physical metal directly from the central banks. What happens is that the central banks lease the gold to other bullion banks such as J.P. Morgan Chase, who either are paid by them or pay them to take this gold in. Of course, it's sold right away. The trick here is that in accounting, they are allowed to carry that gold on the books as if it was still there. They owned it, when in fact they really don't. And when J.P. Morgan Chase pays them for the gold, whether it's in 30 days or 6 months or whatever, then they're going to pay them in U.S. dollars. And so that's how they've been depressing prices as of late, over the last 4 or 5 months. Not that they haven't used it before, they have. But over the last 4 or 5 months, particularly in the last 2 months, they've been using lease gold to knock the price down. Because it's not the shorts that are doing it, because the shorts are all already almost record short. And on Wednesday, I'll be publishing the new short position. And they added, the shorts added to their short position, which is not good for them, because if the price goes up, they're going to be trapped. And so they're not the sellers. The sellers are coming from the central banks who are routing lease gold through bullion bankers, and they think they're hiding their trades, and they're not. You know, people on the floor, they know what's going on. And they know where the gold's coming from.
Well,
fortunately,
Chris,
they have lost that opportunity in silver because they don't have any anymore.
Well, of course, the thing is, if other nations like Russia or like China or like India or the Arab countries were to start buying gold, why, there's not that much gold out there. The price would just shoot right up through the ceiling. I think that there's sort of a gentleman's agreement, of course, that they don't want to collapse the system, at least not just yet. I think the day will come, of course, when the price will go through the roof, but they're doing everything to keep the lid on for the time being. They don't want the foolish Americans to understand that their goose is getting cooked very, very progressively. Let's go to Joe, who's calling from Michigan. Hi, Joe. How are you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
They're doing fine.
That's good. Yeah, the comments, I think you just almost kind of answered it, but the commonsensical contradiction here is, you know, like you were saying, they're making a concerted effort to debauch the currency, thus destroy our economy. But at the same time, they're buying bonds and buying and selling gold to make everything not fall apart. Isn't that a contradiction?
It's a matter of timing. And we've discussed this on this program before. And that is that in 2002, in June, was a point of no return, what they had planned for the destruction of the economies of Europe and the United States and Canada either had to be stopped right there or it had to continue. And they continued it because they felt that in all probability that the effort that they had started in the Middle East would be successful. And as time went on, we found that the action that they'd gotten involved in Afghanistan and Iraq is a disaster. And so they've had to go forward with it anyway, the plan. And so they're trying to extend the problem to a later time period, hoping that they can work their way out of it and then find a better time opportunity to do what they want to do to force the creation and the forced acceptance of world government on people. So when people are hungry, they don't have a job, they have a depression, what happens is they either revolt or they live on their knees. And of course the Illuminists want those people to live on their knees so they can control them. And so it would seem that the goals were at odds with one another when in fact they aren't, if you understand the whole underlying problem and why they did what they did and why they approached it the way they did and what they must do in the future. You see, they're trapped economically and financially. And a great part of this trap was the usage of free trade and globalization, which led to offshoring and outsourcing, which cost America 6 or 7 million jobs over the last 8 years. It's not working.
So is there fear that, like, if they don't do it with the right type of timing, that the people could revolt in some way? Is that one of their fears? Or?
Well, yeah, that is a fear. And that is why today we have over 200,000 mercenaries, because they get paid substantial amounts of money to murder people. And that's why they have them, because they don't have to depend upon the regular military, who are much more subject, perhaps 80%, not fire on their fellow citizens.
And I think that's another reason why they're militarizing our local police. I mean, they're training our local police. They've given them armored vests, and they've given them the helmets and machine guns, automatic weapons. I mean, when did the police need, of course, armored personnel carriers? And yet, of course, the federal government is preparing our local police force to be militarized to use against the American people. If you haven't, Joe, if you haven't seen my talk on the planned police state, and certainly our syllabus, I think it's probably one of the best things out there, that the planned police state DVD and the syllabus that goes with it. It will really explain exactly what's going on to you.
Yeah. I just want to make one quick comment. You might find this kind of cool. You probably already noticed it. But as the price of gas is going up, did you notice they were talking on the radio today about they've lowered the price of RTF for buses? You know, wanting everybody to rely on bus transportation and bikes and so forth. Did you notice that?
Well, they want to get us out of our cars.
Right, that's what
they
I mean.
They want to really lower the living standards of the American people. When you understand that, when you understand there is a master plan that's laid out in the Earth Charter, which anybody can get off the Internet, the Earth Charter, points 10A and 10B. Get it, read it, and weep. And understand these people control the reins of the power and the wealth of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else, Joe, before
we
go?
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Great show.
Okay, God bless. And let's go to Ed calling from Idaho. And again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And Ed is on from Idaho. Hi, Ed. How are you doing?
Great, Dr. Stan. Yourself?
Doing no complaints at all.
Good. Hi, Bob. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Okay. This business with B of A falling 70% on their income, the other problems with other banks losing income, the fuel shortages, the prices of goods going up, food, whatnot, where's this all headed?
Well, we're in a recession for starters. And there's no way I think that they can keep from going into depression. And so they're forced to carry forward with the plans that they originally laid, whether they like it or not. And usually, historically, what they have done through the centuries is when they have a situation like this, they start another war. And that's why George Bush has been so anxious to attack Iran and has made up all sorts of stories about why we should do that. And that's why missiles are being put in position, which are upsetting the Russians, and that could turn into a war as well. And wars are distracting. You don't worry about the economy if you're getting drafted, and I think a move into another company, current country, would bring about a selective service draft. So if you get drafted, you're not worried about the economy, you're worried about whether you're going to survive or not. And so these distractions will happen at the same time. And so when you have those kind of expensive distractions, the economy gets even worse. So I am not very optimistic at all. I think we're going to have recession, depression. I think we're going to have social conflict. We may have a third world war. I mean, who knows? These people are, they're just crazy. And they just power hungry, and they want world government, and they don't care what has to be done to achieve it.
And I think another thing that you're seeing is played out is Revelation 6:8. Thou don't believe that the other set doesn't read that. In fact, if you read the original text of Barbara Marx Hubbard's book, Revelation, the Book of Co-Creation. And remember, Barbara Marx Hubbard is one of the wealthiest women in the world. She ran for the Democratic nomination for the vice presidency back in, I think it was 1982, against Geraldine Ferraro. Fortunately, she lost. But, I mean, she has been very active politically. She's very active politically today. But in that book, which was channeled to her by a demonic spirit, she called it the Christ spirit, but it was a demonic spirit. Basically, she talked about how these things that are in the book of Revelation are going to come to pass. And, of course, remember, of course, and I looked and I saw behold a pale horse, and the rider upon him was death, and Hades followed close behind, and power was given unto them to kill a quarter of the population of the world by the sword. Of course, they're talking about war, by pestilence, by famine, and of course by the beasts of this world. And I think that we're facing famines all throughout the world. Just read the headlines of the last few weeks. We're hearing about food riots all over the world, looming famine. We're even talking about the possibility of food shortages here in the United States. And then, of course, the new diseases which have been created. If you don't believe they can create new diseases, you need to read Zygmunt Bzezinski's book, Between Two Ages. Incidentally, the cheapest one up on the Internet is about, I think over $250, $300. It's called Between Two Ages, written in 1970, when Zygmunt Bzezinski, who incidentally is Barack Obama's foreign policy advisor, Zygmunt Bzezinski, talks about how in the future we're going to be able to create storms and droughts and, of course, chronic diseases to disable the people, or disable the enemy. And, of course, you and I are considered the enemy for the elitists. Anything else you want to say there, Ed?
Well, only that I am a subscriber to the Forecaster, and I look forward to getting it twice a week. And I encourage you both to keep up the great work.
God bless, and thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
And God bless you both.
And so that's a good commentary on unsolicited commentary on the International Forecaster. But Bob, you do a great job of putting that publication up.
Well, thank you. I'm sure put a lot of time in it. I'll tell you that.
I know you do. Well, you got to turn out something 25 pages long every twice a week. I really don't know quite how you do that. But anyway, I appreciate the fact that you do. And certainly, I think that people have to understand that there's something called the Working Group on Financial Markets. That's known as the Plunge Protection Team. It was authorized by President Reagan, and it's being used today to actually manipulate our markets, gold markets, silver markets. And it's all perfectly legal. It's done under presidential authorization. And the average individual sees the market goes up, he thinks that's great. Have you ever noticed how sometimes the market will just plunge and then it'll turn around and go right back up again the very same day? and it'll end up ahead when it was behind before, maybe 250 points down, and then it ends up, you know, 150 or 200 points. That's all manipulation. Let's go to Rick calling from Texas. Hi, Rick. Do you have a question or comment for our guest?
Yes, I just wanted to ask him, how can they keep knocking silver down if they don't have the physical silver to sell into the market?
Hold that thought, and I want you to speak up just a little louder. Bob,
okay.
Did you get the question? How can
yes,
they keep the price of silver down when they don't have any silver to sell in the market? It's all done by manipulation of the commodity market. And I think that's one of the most fascinating questions. Rick, why don't you go ahead and get started answering that? We'll have to break.
We're getting reports from all over the world, and we've been getting them for months. But now it's become acute, and that is that there's an awful lot of silver that's not available in the physical market.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Hang on, Rick. Now, what are you saying? You're saying there's shortages of silver, or there's silver that's out there, but it's not coming into the market? What?
Well, it is coming into the market, but it's my belief that it's coming in the form of 100-ounce bars, which are going to the COMEX in order to complete delivery for people who are taking delivery of the silver contracts, which they purchased. And that leaves the rest of the market naked. The U.S. Mint, for a number of reasons, have not produced the 2008 Silver Eagles. And they're supposed to be out, I guess, in the next several days. And I guess they're going to print about a million of them. And the orders out there are for somewhere in the vicinity of 5 million. And so those are going to be gobbled up pretty fast. They're already selling at a large premium. And pressure is being brought to bear on the gold coin bags, the silver bags, the 90% silver bags, and even in the numismatics as well. And so the physical market is on fire. The public is starting to come in the market from all over the world. And so that means that what you see going on in the futures market is a matter of manipulation. And what happens eventually is that the physical market will overtake the futures market, and what will happen is that volume will drop on the futures market and increase in the spot market, which is the cash market, and the futures market could become a non-entity. And as you may know, the silver commercials, the specialists, have been perpetually short enormous amounts of silver. I run Ted Butler's articles whenever they come out, so the subscribers are very filled in on the silver situation, plus my comments. And I believe that this is going to come to a head shortly. And if there's a silver squeeze, which I think there will be, and silver pops to $30, I can tell you the gold's going right through 1,000 again.
Okay, I think it's all manipulated, Ed. Rick, they can certainly do this, you know, as long as they control the markets. But if the market ever gets out of control, why, heaven help them. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Rick, did that answer your question?
Yes, it did. Thank you.
God bless. And, well, Bob, I want to thank you so very much for being with us again one more time. Why don't you get your telephone number out?
That's 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188.
God bless. We'll talk to you next Monday on our afternoon program.
Okay, so, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And, of course, that was Bob Chapman. Always enjoy having him to bring us up to date with what's going on. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're in terrible times. I want to tell you that food shortages are beginning to develop. They're beginning to develop shortages of rice right here in the United States. In fact, David Sibley from Ready Reserve Foods, who we work with, sent me an email this morning that at least one Costco in Northern California was short on rice, and they were letting people only buy one bag of rice. Why? Because, of course, rice is beginning to get short here in the United States. Our rice crops are not in, at least back in Arkansas, where a lot of our rice comes from, because everything's flooded. And, of course, rice is not available from Australia because they've had a drought for 7 or 8 years. The Indonesians have put a barrier on exporting rice. The Australians are not exporting rice. America may not have an adequate rice crop this year. There are going to be real problems. The price of rice is skyrocketing. The price of wheat is skyrocketing. And it is anticipated, at least according to the article that David sent me, that there will be shortages of cooking oil, of wheat, and of rice here within a relatively short period of time. So if you've not laid in a supply of long-term storage food, don't put it off. We don't know what happens, but we do know there is a long-range plan, of course, for war and for pestilence and for disease and for death to the beasts of this earth. Incredible as it may seem, I really believe that the four horsemen of the apocalypse are mounted and ready for their work, and their work is at hand now. Believe me, the Luciferians know exactly what's going on, and they intend to carry out God's plan. For as Barbara Marx Hubbard says in the original text, which we'll be glad to provide for if you want to see it, of her work, talking about the destruction of a quarter of the world's population, this woman of great wealth and great power says, "That is not your job, my dear, to destroy those people. That is ours, for we are the riders of the pale horse, death." And this is really what it's all about. So if you'd like to get those pages, we'd be glad to provide them for you. If you'd like to get a catalog on, of course, on getting long-term food storage, we'd be glad to send it to you. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you have already a catalog, start making your preparations. And whether you get it through us, you get it through somebody else, the important thing is, at least I hope that some of our people, some of our listeners, or most of our listeners, will have made the preparation so they'll be able to survive, whether it will be an epidemic that won't let us out of our homes, whether it'll be chaotic situations, whether it'll be shortages. You should be prepared for very difficult times, because I believe those difficult times lie ahead, and I believe God's going to allow them to happen, because, of course, this country has turned against God. So certainly our telephone number again, 1-800-544-8927. We hope you'll get my talk on the planned police state and the syllabus that goes with that. My talk on the forbidden secret and the syllabus that goes with that. I hope you'll want to get my talk on the hidden agenda and the syllabus that goes with that. Our talk on sustainable development. And, of course, that has to do with Agenda 21. And, of course, this whole gimmick of global warming, which is a scam. But the solution to global warming is more government power over our lives and the destruction of the industrial base of the United States so that they can impoverish our people. And that's why Al Gore wants this. He was part of the group that came up with this plan back in 1991, 1992, to be prepared to present it to the Second Earth Summit held in Rio de Janeiro in 1992. The elitists want to destroy the middle class. They want to impoverish our people. They want a ruling oligarchy, and Al Gore will be one of them. An inconvenient truth. And then, of course, we hope you'll get our talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness. You get the book that goes with that. And then Pray for America. Pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty. For our provision and protection, our number 1-800-544-8927. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, of course, for the next hour, the views of Barry Shamish, who, is, of course, is an Israeli patriot, who certainly was one of the leading commentators in Israel for many years. He had written extensively on the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, the Israeli premier, and, of course, the Prime Minister of Israel, and, of course, the fact that he was murdered by the Shabbat, which is the Israeli counterpart of the Secret Service. And, of course, he had actually convinced almost 50% of the religious Jews in Israel that his material was actually correct. And he's written extensively about so many of the other crimes that carried out by the Israeli leaders, because the Israeli leaders are tied into the leaders of our own country, into the Council on Foreign Relations, and these elite people whose loyalty is not to the United States, but to this globalist dream of the New World Order, the New World Religion, the New World Leader. And so, without further ado, Barry, what are we going to be talking about this evening?
Well, mostly the Yom Kippur War, because it's been first of all, Shabbat, followed by the Passover holiday, and I've had no news from Israel. Everyone's been offline, and so we have to deal with what we have, but it'll be an important show.
All right, go right ahead.
Well, I'll just finish off with this week's news that I got from America. I didn't need Israel for this. The Pope went into a synagogue in New York, and I was at a, it's called a seder, it's a Passover meal with a little ceremony attached to it yesterday, and our rabbi was so thrilled and so delighted that a Pope would actually present himself to a synagogue, and I was, of course, thoroughly repulsed. This Pope was a member of Hitler Youth, and later on he joined the Wehrmacht. God knows what he did during the Holocaust. You don't invite him into a synagogue. Now, the person next to me said, well, look, when I was 18, I had wild ideas myself. And I said to him, your wild ideas include the genocide of an entire nation. And he sort of quieted down. The fact is, the rabbi in New York, Rabbi Arthur Schneer, is no ordinary rabbi. He is on the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion and Foreign Policy Committee, which he shares with Madeleine Albright. It gets worse. He's on the UN Elite Alliance of the Civilization Initiative, the UN's Civilization Alliance, which is headed by Edgar Bronfman of the Council on Foreign Relations. And his children are all Catholic today, and it was a first-class atrocity that any Nazi would be led into a synagogue. And this is the way Americans think. I mean, the rabbi in our synagogue is a Holocaust survivor, and he's applauding that the Pope, who was a member of the Wehrmacht, went to a synagogue. It's just so, well, the world is upside down.
No, we live in a world gone crazy. There are only a few of us are sane, and everybody thinks we're crazy. Well, we'll be back in just a moment with Barry Shamish as he analyzes what's going on in the world today from his perspective. Barry, go right ahead.
We're going to do the Yom Kippur War, something I've written about, And frankly, I'm the only one who's figured it out. I haven't read this interpretation. It's not an interpretation. It's based on historical facts. Now, what started me was a program on the History Channel about the Bilderbergs. It was on two nights ago. And, by the way, it was pretty darn conspiratorial, I must say, for the History Channel or not. But nonetheless, they interviewed David Icke, who has really amazing problems with Jews and Israel. And this is actually part of conspiratorial history, just what a problem he has with Jews. Nonetheless, what he said on the History Channel was in May of 1973, the Bilderbergs had a meeting where they decide the price of oil must go up. And then came in October the Yom Kippur War, where that's exactly, well, what happened. That was the result of the Yom Kippur War, was today's $117 barrel of oil all came from the Yom Kippur War. And he's certainly right about that. But, well, let's discuss this war right now. Let's begin with the fact that there was no intelligence failure. Now, if you recall, in the 73 war, Israel was caught off guard, and the Arabs attacked when the Israelis least suspected it, and they were overrun immediately. Now, I want to correct that. The Israeli intelligence most certainly predicted a war. They had all the observations of the world that both the Egyptians and the Syrians had gathered, and I'm talking millions of soldiers. Millions! You're talking the entire Egyptian army and Syrian army were at Israel's borders, and the intelligence warned the government that there was going to be a war. But the government had the greatest traitor. And I'm serious when I say the greatest traitor, or equal to Peres, but certainly way up there, that is Moshe Dayan. Moshe Dayan was the defense minister, and Moshe Dayan didn't call out the troops. Worse than that, Moshe Dayan thinned out the troops.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with Barry Sammet. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Barry's talking about the Yom Kippur War. Of course, this is 1973, and was it 1973?
Sure was.
All right, fine. And of course, at that time, the defense leader, the leader of the Department of Defense there, was Moshe Dayan. Now, the Israeli intelligence knew the attack was coming. Yom Kippur is a very Jewish holiday. It's coming up. And, of course, Moshe Dayan, knowing full well, of course, they've massed millions of military soldiers on the Egyptian border, on the Syrian border, knowing the attack is coming, actually begins to thin out Israel's defenses so that they really wouldn't be able to defend themselves effectively when the war came. And you have to ask yourself, why would Moshe Dayan do that? Isn't he supposed to be this great Jewish leader? Of course, you have to remember that it was in 67 and Moshe Dayan had actually turned the Table Mount in Israel over to the Arabs. Why would you do that? I mean, you won the war fair and square, and why wouldn't you keep this, the sacred Jewish place? Why would you leave that right in the heart of Jerusalem as a constant festering sore, you know, as a constant place of contention? And, of course, nobody ever asked the question why Moshe Dayan did that. Supposedly it was a very far-sighted view, or maybe it was just a mistake. We find, of course, they always justify what they do as mistakes. But I don't think these people do make mistakes. So go ahead, pick up the story there. We're getting ready for the attack. The Egyptians are prepared to attack. The Syrians are prepared to attack. And the Israelis are not prepared at all for the attack.
No, but your point was good about 67, but let's not get me lost here. You're right about that. But another time, another show, and we'll talk about 67 and handing over the Temple Mount to the Waqf. But let's stick with 73 right now. Diane, the weekend before the war broke out on October 4th of 73. Diane thinned the troops in the Sinai to 600 soldiers. Now, on the Suez Canal. Now, I assure you, if they had had even partial mobilization, even a few thousand troops, you would have seen it, a million dead Egyptians. They would not have crossed. But he thinned the troops to only 600 along the Suez Canal. Now, he thinned the Golan troops, but at the last second, in a very revealing moment, Moshe Dayan added 50 tanks to the Golan Heights, which it had an effect. The Syrians lost most of their armored personnel, but not all. Now, I want to remind to many of these people, of your listeners, this won't be a reminder at all. To others, it will be. The Syrians made it across the Golan. They made it to the bridges on the Jordan River. Syria could have been in the Galil on the second day of the war, but they stopped dead in their tracks at the Jordan River. And the reason for that is there was a deal cut, which was, to explain it simply, you don't go into pre-67 Israel. That's the deal. This is a deal, by the way, that Moshe Dayan made with Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State of the United States, so there's no mistake about that, and we'll get to that shortly, that even if you get the Golan back, you don't come into pre-67 Israel. Otherwise, Syria would have. They stopped dead at the Jordan River. Now, what we were told in Israel, and what all the history books keep repeating from one source, is that the Syrians outran their supply lines. That is so stupid. You can drive across the Golan Heights one end to the other in 1 hour. That's all it takes. You don't outrun supply lines when they're an hour away. You resupply in an hour. They stuck to the terms of the agreement. They didn't walk into Israel. That was the deal cut. You take back the Sinai and the Golan, and you don't go into Israel. Now, luckily for us, on the Golan, we had a very brave commander named Mordechai Kalani, who managed to, with his 50 tanks, down to his last tanks, managed to wreck the Syrian armored brigade over a few days, but nonetheless, the Syrians could have been in Tiberias that day. The second day of the war, they would have been running across the Golan, except Kissinger's rules were you stop at the 67 border. Now, what I'm going to say is a little shocking, but what David Icke said was right. The Bilderbergs decide the oil must go up in May. But what the Yom Kippur War did, thanks to Diane, is the Yom Kippur War started the biggest money transfer in history, because very shortly after the war began, the OPEC nations, mostly Arab, put an embargo on oil on the United States and Holland. There was no more oil sent to the United States and Holland. I don't know if you remember 73, but Americans were waiting in very long gas lines, during the Yom Kippur War and afterwards. Because the embargo wasn't lifted for a few months after that.
Because I can remember also, of course, the stories about the oil tankers loaded with oil sitting off the coast, or the phrase, tanker trucks, you know, gasoline tanker trucks, are filling up the tanks at empty service stations. Anything to, you know, to prevent the American people from getting oil. So, I mean, I think that they're certainly the, I believe Kissinger and Nixon told the Arabs to go ahead and raise the price of oil, going right along with the Kissinger, with the Bilderberger's dictates. But I believe
well before the war broke out. Now, if you think you suffered, Israel suffered 3,000 dead in the first 2 days of that war. What Diane cost Israelis, what he did to the mothers and the families of those 3,000 soldiers, is way worse than waiting in a gas line. But why not say that? I mean, he was a traitor to the Jewish people in a huge way, and the Yom Kippur War was a war Israel could have won hands down if its armies were mobilized. 600 soldiers along the Suez just could not hold back the Egyptian army of a million men. That's obvious. 6,000, I think, could have, but he thinned them out. Now back to the reason for the war, and David Icke and the Bilderbergs decide the oil prices have to go up after the embargo. And remember, this is during the war. A barrel of oil went from 30 cents to 60 to a buck. Within a few months, a barrel of oil was $2 a barrel, something unheard of in 73. Today it's 117 a barrel, but in 73, this was the year of cheap oil. This was the greatest, well, the Arabs just put in their coffers all the oil of the West, and they had billions and trillions of dollars. This was the greatest West-to-East money transfer in history.
Well, don't you think that there was also an agreement that that they would invest their money in the United States? In other words, we'd let them get the money.
Oh, you just took the words out of my mouth.
Okay, go ahead. I didn't mean to steal your lines there.
No. That was a deal. You're absolutely right. The money went into New York banks. That's exact. Now, remember, the Arabs couldn't spend this amount of money. They didn't have the infrastructure to spend the money that suddenly came their way, and it was transferred to American banks. Now, the biggest by far recipient of Arab money was the Chase Manhattan Bank of the Rockefeller family, or the CFR. Okay, just so you know. But Citicorp got a real big chunk of it as well, and there were a few London banks that got some money as well. The point is, where did this money go? Now, we'll go back to the war. Let's look at the result of the war before we go back to the war itself. American banks lent the money to engineering disasters all through South America and lesser so in Africa. But in South America, every dictator who had a dam to build got free money. And by the end, within a year or two, Argentina was bankrupted. Mexico was bankrupted. The world went into a debt crisis directly because of the Yom Kippur War. And what it came down to, well, the Mexican oil reserves were all owned by the American banks, all of them. Argentina as a nation, including all its beef, by the way, which is not the same as oil, but they were all indebted to New York banks who took Arab money and, well, what can you say? They bankrupted the Third World. This all happened in 1974 and 5.
And
I hear the music.
And right, well, actually, we carry a book written by a man who actually was assigned by the National Security Agency, the super secret spy ring, to actually go down to the various countries in South America and throughout the world and to get them into debt to using this money. And of course, this is money then was lent by our banks to these corporations, to these companies, and or these countries, and then we would own the dictators there. If they didn't go along with it, why, they were assassinated. The book is Confessions of an Economic Hitman. We have a 4-tape set of my interviews with this man who worked secretly behind the scenes. Go right ahead, Barry.
That sounds like actually something I'd want to read.
The book is called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. You've never read it?
No.
All right, fine. I'll ask if we... I think we still have copies, and I'll have either Barbara or Letitia send you a copy. Would you want to hear my interviews with Perkins, or would you rather read the book?
Either way, it fits in with what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah,
the American banks receive, I don't know if it was trillions of dollars, but the Arabs transferred the money to New York banks who lent the money to third world dictatorships and caused a debt crisis.
You're right. Absolutely right. I'll get you a copy of the book. Fascinating. It fits in exactly with what you're saying.
I'm going to give some personal information shortly where I got the information, but let's finish off the war first of all. Look, it's a tragedy for Israel. Israel may have won, but a victory like that is no victory. 3,000 dead within 2 days. That's unspeakable. 10,000 wounded. And when you're wounded in war, by the way, it doesn't mean you have a scratch to your knee. You could be blinded, castrated. I mean, war wounds are very serious. But that's what Diane did. Now, on the eighth day of the war, Israel was in very serious trouble. It was out of ammunition. Now, I've talked to people about that. Some people say it's not true. There was still enough ammunition to go for a few weeks. Most agree that Israel had used up its ammo. Now, at this point, Henry Kissinger, who, again, with Diane, had come up with a scheme that Israel give up the Golan Heights to the Syrians and not mobilize its army. The army got mobilized only, 48 hours after the war began. The army was fully mobilized. Well, there's a major, major issue going on. There's no ammo. And the Russians are resupplying the Syrians. And by the way, Marvin Antleman, says the loan came from J.P. Morgan, Morgan Grenfell in London, for the Syrians to buy the Russian arms. This will get too lost if we go into these little subtleties, but the fact remains, Israel was out of arms. The Syrians were being reloaded. There were Sukhovs, big Russian carriers, landing in Damascus, and Israel was going to lose because it simply didn't have the arms. And Kissinger, I don't know why he ever said this, but this quote is extremely well known, said that he wanted Israel to be bloodied. He wanted Israel to have a bloody nose. It would make them more pliable in negotiations with the Arabs. Now, I want to stress, no Jew would want their relatives to die. Being bloodied means your people are dying. But that's what Kissinger announced. Golda Meir on the eighth day phoned Nixon. And this is a famous story. That Nixon got a call at 3 in the morning from Golda Meir, and she said, "Mr. President, only you can save the Jews." That's his hokey, smoky, ridiculous story.
Hold that story. We'll be right back in just a minute. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Barry was simply talking about here. That's about the eighth day of the war, the Yom Kippur War, 1973. Israel is literally out of ammunition. Henry Kissinger is doing everything he can to block Israel from getting ammunition and weapons to continue the war. The Russians are providing arms for Syria, and of course J.P. Morgan Chase is providing the money for Syria to buy the arms from the Russians, and Israel has no ammunition to continue the war. So there at 3 o'clock in the morning, why, of course, Golda Meir gives a call to Richard Nixon. You pick up the story there.
Well, the Christian fundamentalists repeat this story like it's a lesson that we should all get shivers down our backs from, and it's a lie, by the way. This I'll tell you what really happened. But their story is that Golda phones up Nixon and said, Mr. President, only you can save the Jews. And in the morning, Nixon remembers something his Quaker mother once told him, that someday you would be in a position to save the Jews. All a lie. But you get this stuff spread around. The people who want Israel to be Disneyland have these heart-rendering stories that just aren't true. What happened is a deal was cut, and it was a lousy deal for Israel, because it brought Yitzhak Rabin into leadership of Israel. And this is something I know a lot about. An awful lot about his Yitzhak Rabin. Nixon, now we don't know if he told Golda Meir this or if he told Kissinger this, whatever, however, and by the way, Simchat Zinitz was the negotiator for these arms. It's complicated. But Israel only received arms if Golda Meir agreed to resign after the war. Resign as Prime Minister of Israel and replace herself with Yitzhak Rabin. Now, and by the way, this war produced Israel's grand peacemakers, Yitzhak Rabin and Ariel Sharon. But let's start with this issue of the eighth day of the war. They say, okay, Golda, we'll give you the arms, but when the war ends, you are going to resign. Now, Yitzhak Rabin never served in the Knesset. He was on the labor list, labor party list. He wasn't number 90. He was nowhere near the front of the labor party list. He was, in fact, the ambassador to Washington at the time of the war. And he was a Kissinger poodle. Rabin became literally a puppy for Kissinger. And more to the point, in 72, Rabin campaigned for Nixon. Now, remember, this man was supposedly a socialist kibbutznik who had nothing to do with Republicans and their philosophy. Rabin fell hard in the Kissinger. Well, you can say Nixon, but it was Kissinger and the CFR pool of deceit. And one of the conditions is that Golda Meir, if she wants arms, is going to figure out a way that Rabin becomes the next prime minister. Now, that was not an easy task to do, because there were about 90 people in front of him. So what she does, immediately, she appoints him Minister of Labor, a very second-rate post, and got away with it. He was a general, and then he was ambassador to Washington. He is not even in the Knesset, not even a member of the Knesset. He becomes Minister of Labor. From this humble little post, he did just such a fabulous job with Israeli labor that within 3 months, Golda Meir resigned, and she left the name of her predecessor.
Her successor.
That's not the exact word. of the successor.
Right.
Her successor would be Yitzhak Rabin. We finally got Rabin as Prime Minister of Israel. Mayer arranged it in order to get arms, in order to save herself in this war.
Well, that's a fascinating story. Is there any proof of that at all? Or
oh, my Lord. You have to get my books for this, or else we do a separate show on Rabin's career.
All right, fine. Well, certainly we know that the Americans did provide the weapons, and then Israel suddenly snatched the victory out of the jaws of defeat, and it was a glorious defeat, although at a terrible, terrible price. We'll be back in just a moment here. Okay, this is Dr. Stan Berry. Go right ahead with that story.
Well, just to offer a little bit of superficial proof, Rabin was never a Knesset member. Suddenly he became a minister. That's the first time in Israeli history that someone came from outside the political realm and became minister of anything in a cabinet. And as for appointing him prime minister, never has a prime minister favored her successor. What can you say? The circumstances are the proof in this case. There was no precedent ever for a prime minister resigning and leaving as her successor the Minister of Labor. That never happened before. So leave circumstance and call that proof for now. Now, where I'm going to tell you real circumstance with tremendous eyewitness accounts. By the way, before I do that, please keep in mind, we don't know if getting the Arab money led directly to the bankruptcy of Argentina and Mexico. The fact is the American banks who received the Arab oil money lent the money without any, really, there was no overseeing of these loans and these countries bankrupted themselves. I think we can live with the fact that it was Arab money that bankrupted Argentina, Mexico, did a real good job on Bolivia, Nigeria, and again, it's in my books, and you'll see the process. This war was to make a heck of a lot of money in a major hurry. The Arabs got the money, the American banks got it secondhand, and the Third World got screwed. Okay, that's the result of the Yom Kippur War. Now let's go on to how it was as if Israel has been thoroughly worked over with 3,000 dead at the end of their war. But an odd hero comes out of the war, someone no one expected. Now, Israel survived the war and won the war, by the way, largely because of two, General Ariel Sharon and Colonel Mordechai Kalani on the Golan Heights, who fought the Syrians and held the line.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here, Barry. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Before we get back to the story of the Yom Kippur War, Barry, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get your books, how they can get to your website, and how they can get in touch with you if they want to.
Oh, thank you for this opportunity. The books are all at lulu.com. You go to www.lulu.com, and there's a box in the right-hand corner that says search, write my name, Chamish, that's Chamish, and they'll get to the books. On the Yom Kippur War, you know what, buy all the books. It's such an important event that it actually goes through all my books. The website, you go to barrychamish.com and go into the archives. if you're interested in this subject. And the archives have work thanks to someone in Hawaii and someone in Nevada. We have archives that go back years, and I have DVDs to sell. The most popular, apparently, is the Secret War, the Secret Crusade of the Vatican. I've got a new DVD called Take Back Israel, where I suggest what can be done, and I've got several others. You may call me at 904-501-7605. That's 904-501-7605. Now we're back to the Yom Kippur War.
All right, fine. And of course, Cindy, outgunned, outmanned, outnumbered, how did the Israelis win the Yom Kippur War once they got the supplies from the Americans?
Well, you have officers who weren't aware of the secret deal between Diane, Moshe Diane, and Kissinger. And by the way, over time I've come to the conclusion that Golda Meir wasn't involved in the pre-war deal, where the Arabs get 24 hours to do whatever they want with Israel. That's what Diane did. And why he put 50 tanks on the Golan the night before the war is he realized the Sinai could hold on for a few days, whereas the Golan couldn't. So he put a few more tanks to stop the attack. But I don't think Golda Meir knew. I think she was just so simply out of it that when Israel was pushed to the point where it could lose. And by the way, the Yom Kippur War was very touch and go. Don't think because Israel it did win that they couldn't have lost. They certainly could have lost. If the Syrians had gone to the Galilee instead of obeying this deal they cut with Kissinger, Israel would have lost the war. Well, for that matter, if Jordan had entered the war, Israel would have lost the entire West Bank and possibly Jerusalem. There are a lot of ifs here. This deal by Diane almost cost Israel the country. Now, we're gonna talk about this issue, and then we'll come back. All right, I'm going to do one other thing. With Menachem Begin, before we go into Sharon, let's stick with Diane for a little bit. When Menachem Begin was elected prime minister in 1977, I was a student at Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Excuse me. Now, what was it? 2, 3, 4 days after his election, he appointed Moshe Dayan as his foreign minister. Now, I didn't know Israeli politics back then, and I said that's a great idea. I was in a conversation with Israelis, and I said it's a great idea for Diane's prestige. Israel might come out ahead because of the respect he has as a diplomat. And I remember one Israeli student said, well, you didn't fight in the Yom Kippur War. I did. I don't want him as foreign minister of Israel. I want him tried for his crimes. And I didn't understand how right he was. But after Begin was elected, there was a president of the United States, Jimmy Carter, who, by the way, his meetings with Hamas just proves what a true blue Jew-hating son of a bitch he really was. But Carter pushed Begin, I mean, threatened him, and I've heard this from lots of people, to accept Diane as his foreign minister. There was no reason for this other than American pressure. So Diane eventually led to the Camp David Accords with Sadat. Now, here I've got myself a very, very strong witness. His name was Yossi Orr. I was in his office. He was one of the co-inventors of the Uzi machine gun. He was Israeli establishment right from the beginning of the state. He knew the inside of Israel. And he told me, he says, you don't know what went on with Begin, what Diane did to him. He says, they met Carter's team. It was Vance Brzezinski, Mondale. He said, and by the way, all CFR, every one of them, CFR, they said their strategy, which they planned with Moshe Dayan and Ezra Weitzman, the other appointment of Dayan to the government, was to totally isolate Begin and make him think that every opinion he shared was wrong. And Yossi Orr said to me, they drugged his coffee. On top of everything else, they drugged his coffee. Begin didn't know where East and West was. They completely isolated him, and they had him completely convinced that he had to be wrong. He said that was the pre-Camp David Accords where they got to Begin, and that is why Diane, who was a traitor to Israel, look, Peres is worse, but Diane is second. During the Yom Kippur War, he oversaw the killing of, first 2 days, 2,000, 3,000 by the end of the war, because he cut a deal with Kissinger. The Yom Kippur War was a CFR war. And I've got the facts and I've got the names, and it was done in coordination with the Arabs, and it was an economic war. The world changed after the Yom Kippur War in ways the world doesn't even understand now. And now we go back to Sharon. Sharon disobeyed the army command. He was a general. He was a very, very pro-Israel, proud Jewish general. And he said, to hell with the command. Look at the mess they've got us into. We're going to cross the Suez Canal and we're going to surround the Egyptians. And that's precisely what he did. By the end of the war, he had surrounded the 9th, 3rd Army, I believe, not 9th, 3rd Army, completely surrounded. Thousands and thousands of Egyptian troops were now totally surrounded. If Israel pulled the noose, all of them would have died. Nobody expected Sharon. He wasn't anticipated. The war ended with an Israeli victory because of Sharon. Now that, something had to be done with the Sharon, and something was done with the Sharon. As I said, the two peacemakers, Rabin and Sharon, came out of the Yom Kippur War. Now, I don't know, do I have the time to tell you about my eyewitness report?
I think so. You've got about 8 minutes.
Pardon me?
You got about 8 minutes.
I'm going to do it fast then.
All right, go ahead.
I found out about Sharon through two means. One was me and Joel Bainerman, my partner in the newsletter Inside Israel, interviewed Benny Begin, Menachem Begin's son. And he was very coy, and it seemed like he wasn't helping us, but he was. And he says to us, the Israelis don't understand who Sharon really is. And he explains that Sharon, in 1974, was not a right-wing Israeli. He told us he was never a right-wing Israeli. He was from a kibbutz. He grew up left-wing. His best friend was Shimon Peres. He said he has no right to lead the right. And he got worse. He said he killed my father. And we found out from Menachem Begin's son that Sharon was a phony, that he was not representing the right. And then Sharon in 1997 was minister of the infrastructure. Infrastructure means roads and sewers and whatever else. My friend Joel Bainerman is in New York. He's at an economic conference for Israel at the Sheraton Hotel. He phones me up and he says, you won't believe what I just saw. I just saw Sharon enter a private room with Henry Kissinger. Next day, I phoned Sharon's spokesman, Ranan Gissin, who, believe it or not, was so vain, somebody offered him a Hollywood contract if he played ball with the Americans, and he accepted it. He never appeared in any movie. But that's the kind of vanity and stupidity that's around Israel's leadership. I phoned him up and I said, what was Sharon doing with Kissinger in New York yesterday? And he went on, he said the minister, he called him the minister. He said the minister had visited Kissinger every day since January of 1974. On every trip to America, he always visits Kissinger. And I said, what for? He said, to discuss peace. And I said, why would Sharon, minister of infrastructure, discuss peace with Kissinger? He should be discussing sewers. And then he said, you're right. They weren't discussing peace. They were discussing roads. He just backtracked. And I said, Mr. Gissin, what do you know about the Council on Foreign Relations? And I got an answer I'll never forget. I wrote it down, but I'll still never forget it. He said, the minister has informed me that his relationship to that organization cannot be explained until he writes his memoirs. I said, all right. So that's the story, that he knows all about Kissinger and the CFR. And he says, I can't comment on that. In short, after the Yom Kippur War, Sharon was the only hero who wasn't sullied by this horrible loss Israel suffered. He was the hero. Now, before the war, he had quit the army. He was a reserve general, and he had formed a political party called Shlom Tzion. It was a left-wing party, and he had invited major left-wingers, Yossi Sarid and Lipkin Shachak, Amnon Lipkin Shachak. If you're Israeli, you know these people as leaders of the left. But Kissinger invited him to New York and said, no, take your party, and I want you to join it with Begin's Chayrut party. Form another party, but destroy the Chayrut from the leadership of this party, which is what Sharon did. He formed the Likud. The Likud could not have been formed without him. He won the election with Begin in 77. By 82 and the Lebanon War, he had completely driven Begin crazy. And by 75, Begin was no longer a political force. Shortly afterwards, over time, he took over the Likud, and Israel no longer had a right-wing, never had a right-wing prime minister after Shamir, because Sharon was working for the left, disguising it as a right-wing patriot, all because of the Yom Kippur War, when he surrounded the Egyptians and fought the establishment of Israel. The Yom Kippur War, first of all, was ruined in the strangest way South America and also Nigeria and parts of Africa by rotten loans coming from the oil embargo, coming from a massive amount of money caused by the rise in the price of oil from 30 cents to $2. All the money came from Europe and America to Arab banks. They transferred it to New York banks. The New York banks used it to cause the debt crisis primarily in South America. This was all the Yom Kippur War, all of it, and it was all planned. As for Israel, received its two great peacemakers, Rabin and Sharon, and Israel went straight down the tubes. Now, I want to remind our listeners again those who know a little Israeli history, when the Sinai was removed from Israel, and for the so-called Camp David peace accords, and we know Egypt has reneged on them, and we know they were worthless in the long run, nonetheless, there was a community that said to Al-Wadis, well, what are we giving up what we built for? What are we getting out of it? The community was Yamit. Yamit had 2,500 residents. It was on the Mediterranean coast between Gaza and El Arish. Sharon went in and bulldozed the town. General Sharon went in and hit Yamit and bulldozed every building in that town and forced out all of the naysayers from bunkers. They were hiding in bunkers. Anything to get them out, he got them out. Sharon did not just merely destroy Gush Katif or Gaza. Sharon, the peacemaker, destroyed the Sinai settlements, but especially he's famous for wrecking the largest settlement of all, Yamit. All of this came out, and ultimately, of course, the Jews of Gaza paid the price for the Yom Kippur War. Nobody realized what a true disaster it was for Israel and the world. I hope I cleared something up.
All right, fascinating. And Barry, we always enjoy your interpretation. Now, of course, Gaza is being used as a base for the Palestinians, so they can lob their missiles on into southern Israel. We'll be right back in just a moment. Why don't you just go ahead and fit in? You've got 3 minutes now to wrap up the program.
Well, you know, this was actually a lot to take in, but you have to look at Israeli history in light of the fact that Israel is being used. And by the way, I mean being used. I don't even know if Diane realized the disaster he was creating for Israel by not having his forces ready. All I know is that they were not mobilized until over 2,000 were dead. That is the legacy of Moshe Dayan. Lest anyone think that Moshe Dayan was a great Israeli, he could not have been worse. This is something just not understood by people, and I think by exposing this, we can sort this mess out. And if anyone thinks that Nixon saved Israel, the price was so high, it ended up being the Oslo so-called peace accord, because he put Rabin in power. Nothing is as anything seems in Israel. There's always a piper to be paid. There, that's my message.
All right, fine. And, Chris, question, why would Sharon, of course, the hero of the Yom Kippur War, why would he, of course, then betray Israel?
You know what? You're asking the question, the almighty question, isn't there a proud Jew who doesn't accept money, who doesn't accept fame or power? Sharon was promised immense power if he would destroy Begin. I can talk about Sabra and Shatila and the fact that Sharon let it go on for 3 days and the fact that Begin was the loser. He was never prime minister again after 85, and Sharon was prime minister. Simply power.
All right, well, all right, fine. Well, anyway, it's a. And of course, most people believe that Moshe Dayan was the hero of the Yom Kippur War, and your story is they won the war in spite of Moshe Dayan. Would that
Moshe
be a fair?
Moshe Dayan truly, truly was a traitor to the Jewish people in the most blatant and truly repulsive sense.
All right, fine. Well, our guest has been Barry Shamish. Of course, you get his books at lulu.com. Fascinating reading, fascinating insight into the secret history of Israel that you won't get any other place else, but it ties into the secret history of America and the Council on Foreign Relations and the fact that we have traitors whose dedication is not to America, but to the internationalist dream. Good night, Barry. God bless. We'll Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoy our conversations with Barry Shamish. I know I always do. He is certainly on the front lines of the Israeli issue. He certainly knows it better than anybody else I know. And he's met so many of the key people, and his books and his DVDs and his information, I think, is valid. I would not have him on if I didn't have the greatest respect for his knowledge, and will give you an entirely different version of the history of Israel. Well, this is, of course, the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. We're dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day, and then on a weekend program as well. I would love to be able to expand our programs. Quite frankly, financial limitations prevent us from doing it. And if you'd like to become part of our a family of supporters, and a lot of people are having problems now, I realize it. But if you're one of those who at least is in a position to help, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927, and help us pay for our radio bills, almost $100,000 a year just for the radio and radio uplinks that we have. But what a wonderful opportunity to talk to people all across the world. And we do that, and when you join the Radio Liberty family, you become part of our effort. Then, of course, we do hope that many of you out there will want to get some of our material. You can go to our website, radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs there on the Internet 4 hours a day. You can listen to our live feed to the satellite 9 hours a day, our archive programs or MP3 programs. Watch our DVDs. Read our newsletters, but help us get the truth out. Nothing is it appears to be. Why? Because our reality is created by the people who control the media, and they all tie into the Council on Foreign Relations. And the Council on Foreign Relations is a front for a secret society that was created back in 1891 by Cecil Rhodes. If you want to verify what I'm saying, the book written by Professor Carol Quigley, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, that's Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, which is available from Radio Liberty, although it was suppressed for many years. If you doubt that it was suppressed, we have an interview with Professor Quigley where he tells how his book was suppressed. And, of course, these are available at the four-tape set, the Secret Government four-tape set, or you can get that with the Tragedy and Hope special. You need to have the information. And, of course, Professor Quigley was a left-wing liberal who really felt that what's going on was good. I mean, the fact that these foolish Americans really believed there was a danger of communism, they believed there were communists working in our State Department and communists working within our government and turning Eastern Europe and China over to the communists at the end of the Second World War, it wasn't them at all. It wasn't the communists. The communists were there. Of course they were there. But it was the Anglo-American establishment, the CFR group, which, of course, interlocks with the British. And, of course, they were all a front for this secret society dedicated to world government. That's Tragedy and Hope. It's available through Radio Liberty. And they've done everything they could to suppress that book to keep it, of course, from being widely read. Because they cannot let you understand about the Council on Foreign Relations or the myriad of secret and occult organizations. And, of course, Professor Quigley did not recognize the occult nature of what he had uncovered. And certainly he was indebted to Professor Quigley for what he told us, but he only got half the story. The rest of the story takes you into the occult world movement, of which, of course, Cecil Rhodes and Lord Milner is the closest associate, and, of course, Lord Brent, I should say Brent, who later became Lord Escher, and, of course, William Stead. William Stead was deeply involved in spiritualism and the occult. And, of course, those were the four men who formed the secret society, and soon they surrounded themselves with other people who were involved in, of course, secret societies and the occult. The common goal, of course, through all the secret societies down through the ages has been a one-world government. That's why you need, of course, to hear my talk on the forbidden secret and, of course, to get the syllabus that goes with that. Our talk on the hidden agenda and the syllabus that goes with that. The talk on Iraq, the untold story, and the syllabus. Please pray for America. Our number 1-800-